was late April 1975. The Vietnam War was coming to an end. And all the people who could get out of Vietnam because they had money were out.
To describe the town for you, it had one stoplight, no McDonald's, no Wendy's. The closest thing to them was 45 minutes away.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Soup Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Hinken.
And on the podcast this week, our theme is the kindness of strangers, because everybody could be using some kindness right now. And actually, I could be using some more strangers right now. I would love to interact with some strangers. How about you, Jessica?
Oh, my God. Just anyone,
please.
Serial killers, bring them on, as long as they're human.
As long as you're wearing a mask, washing your hands. Before we get started with our first story of the episode, we want to thank Park School of Baltimore, which is an independent, co-ed, non-sectarian school in North Baltimore.
This episode of the podcast has two stories that were recorded at Park School for an event that they have called Brain Spark. And the first storyteller is named Terry Nguyen. And she's going to be sharing this story about her experience coming to America from Vietnam. Take a listen.
It was late April 1975. The Vietnam War was coming to an end. And all the people who could get out of Vietnam because they had money were out. The American corporations that were there had already evacuated their employees. My parents did look for a way out, but being educated upper middle class folks, we didn't have the kind of money still to leave the country. So we did have a bag packed in case an opportunity would come up. How or when, I don't know. My parents did know that they didn't want to stay back with the communists. My parents as teenagers had already left North Vietnam back in 54 when the country split between North and South Vietnam, and North Vietnam was under communist regime. So April 1975, no way out. My dad's working for the government. He is a member of the cabinet. My mom works for an American bank, Chase Manhattan Bank. And there were rumors that they were evacuating some of their employees. Definitely their American employees had been evacuated. What were they going to do with their Vietnamese employees? They didn't know. It was all in limbo. That was until my mother came home one afternoon from work, and she said, I just got an order to pick up the immediate family, because at that in Vietnam, you have to say nuclear family, because if you say, grab your family and come to the airport, do you know what would happen? Grandma, grandpa, cousins, aunts, uncles, you know, the housekeeper. My mom comes to fetch my sister, who's 9 months old, and me from my grandmother's house. My grandmother is at church. And then we went to fetch my dad. I think she might have marched in there and pulled him out. And he was horrified, and he was like, do you know? And then when she told him why he was being pulled out, he's like, okay, let's go. The men were hidden under the suitcases, under the seats on the bus. And bribery gets everything done. The American folks bribed our bus driver to play that the lights were not working when the military police came onto the bus, because that's a scary moment. It was going to decide if we were going or not going, or who was going to get pulled off that bus. And it worked. Yeah, the lights weren't working, and this is just a bus of women and children with some American folks from an American bank. Okay, so we made it through the checkpoint. Huge relief, really. And then we were in the airport probably most of the night. I don't know what was going on. Maybe there wasn't a plane. I don't know. By the early morning hours, we boarded an Army military cargo plane. I'd never been on a plane before. And the pictures that I saw in the movies, the planes were much fancier than what I got on. It was cold. We were sitting It was a plane that you sat on the sides of the plane, it's just two sides of the plane. Definitely military people with guns and stuff. I was like, okay, it's my first plane ride though, okay. A little scary, not what I was expecting. I don't know what I was expecting. And that was my memory of that flight. Scary, cold, and a little dangerous. Well, at least people with guns. We arrived in Guam, and I thought I'd arrived in the United States proper. We got put up in, it's probably a Holiday Inn, but I'd never been into a hotel before. This was pretty swank, according to me, my six-year-old self. It had elevators. The environment was controlled. I don't know if we had air conditioning or heat, but it was quite pleasant. I was like, wow, okay, I could do this. So one of my first memories, my American memories, I think, was the food. So we go in and we eat breakfast. What am I offered? Cold cereal with cold milk. I'm like, wait a second, where's breakfast? Where's my soup? Where's my noodle soup? Pho? Or maybe just a porridge, you know, it's all savory. That's what we ate. Or maybe even a little toast, you know. And they're like, oh, you want something warm? Okay. They bring out the warm oatmeal. I'm like, what is this? So I think I skipped breakfast. That was I'm a big foodie, and these are my memories of food as we were coming here. Okay, that was Guam. Then we got to do a little bit more of the refugee experience because our next stop was to Camp Pennington. Camp Pennington ended up being a very big refugee camp for the Vietnamese in the 1970s. But we were, again, very lucky. We spent a few nights there only. So there were tents and cots, but, we stayed less than a week. Whereas my mom's extended family that came by boat, and they were at sea for like a good 6 months, when they went to Camp Pennington many months after we did, they were there for weeks or months waiting for sponsors. But we were very lucky. We had automatic sponsors, Chase Manhattan Bank. So this, to me, is there was an America where corporate level, there was generosity, and on a human person by person level, there was generosity. Because we had sponsors, we got to move from our refugee camp just a few days, just so they could do our paperwork, and we're greeted by our sponsor family at the airport. I know, this is such a rare immigrant experience, honestly. So how did Chase arrange for the sponsor families? They asked their employees. We have this huge group of Vietnamese refugees coming, and please volunteer if you would like to sponsor a family. And there were obviously a lot of volunteers. I don't think there was money involved, guys. These people just volunteered, okay? They opened their homes to these immigrant families who maybe one parent spoke English, the kids didn't, and, you know, it just was an unknown. But our sponsor family who, you know, they're part of our family. I mean, we've grown up with them. But so their family, they had three boys, 6, 5, and 4. And then they took in my family, had me, who was 6, and my sister, who was 9 months old. The parents gave up their master suite, which had its own bathroom, to my parents and my sister and myself. It's the biggest place in the house. The parents in that family, they actually took to sleeping in the family room on the pullout couch. Yeah. When we got on our feet and were able to get an apartment in Queens, New York, we had no money, no furniture. We got into a 2-bedroom apartment through the generosity of people, of the church and our sponsors and their friends and families. We wouldn't have been able to do all that. That's it. Thanks.
So what I love about Terry's story is just how, to this day, she remains an incredibly optimistic person who just sees her journey as nothing but positive. She's extremely aware of how, you know, unique her experience was. And she's very grateful. She gives back to the community in a number of ways. And she's just a delightful human being. I really enjoyed getting to know her.
Yeah, I feel like what I find myself needing and wanting right now is like actual authentic pep talks. Like not just, hey, there's, you know, it'll all be okay. Or, hey, you know, don't worry or whatever. But like actual stories of people who have done hard things and gotten through it. I don't need to hear like only pandemic all the time. And in fact, we don't think you all want to hear that either. That's why we're sharing these stories this week. But just hearing stories of people who have met challenges with, you know, creativity and grace and resilience. I'm finding that really a balm right now.
Absolutely. I agree.
So before we get on to our next story, we want to thank a couple other sponsors. Baltimore Magazine has been a great sponsor of The Soup, and you can check them out at baltimoremagazine.com. They have been doing great coverage of Baltimore area COVID stuff, as well as their usual great restaurants, arts events, and all of that. And we want to thank Golden West, which is still serving food during COVID.
Absolutely.
And has been a terrific sponsor. And you should check them out on the Avenue in Hamden.
So the second storyteller for this podcast episode is, his name is Farivar Zarvesh. And his story, he starts it after he has already gotten to America. But some of the backstory, just for you as a listener to know going in, is that he grew up in Iran, and he had experience watching all of the kids in his neighborhood go to America for education and then return to Iran, and they just all seemed so much cooler and more sophisticated, and he very much wanted to have that, and his parents provided that experience for him and his brother. So the story starts when he and his brother have arrived in America. Take a listen.
July 13th, 1978. I think every one of us here always knows the day we landed. So we land in California. I'm 14. My brother, who was also with me, was 15. And there were a couple other kids right around our age group. We had two grown-ups with us, not our parents. The idea was we came here to live with American families that were hosting separately. So every one of us would be in a different family. This would force us to speak English, learn the culture and so forth, and ultimately go to high school and then college and then get back home, do our thing. We did that for a while. Didn't quite go so well, had nothing to do with the families. It was just too much of a shock at that age without parents and so forth. I'm going to skip through this part of the story, but just to tell you that one of the kids that was in our group was a year or two older than we were, but he was much bigger. Somehow we managed to fake an ID and be able to move out and go get an apartment. This is Fresno, California. Our journey actually took them away from us, and ultimately we followed and ended up in suburbs of LA, Riverside, Downey area. And then subsequently, somehow we ended up in West Virginia. In a very small town in West Virginia. And to describe the town for you, it had one stoplight, no McDonald's, no Wendy's. The closest thing to there was 45 minutes away. It did have a high school and a state college. Now, the reason we went there, it sounds ambiguous, was there were people in California, and at this time, all of our funding is coming from our parents. There were people in California who our parents knew who were supposed to sort of oversee us, but they were trying to take financial advantage, and we just weren't going to go for that. There was somebody else, a relative, who had ended up in West Virginia. Kind of made sense for us to go there. He was a little bit older than we were, but that was enough reason for us to come to West Virginia. So we did. Now, This is within 6 months of us being in the United States. Not that long, right? Meanwhile, when I was back home, I'd studied English, grammar. I was pretty decent with grammar, but not speaking. I said, yeah, to everything people told me. I shook my head. I did all the right things. I had no clue what people were saying. But while we were in California, I felt pretty good about communicating. When I got to West Virginia, it truly was a challenge because terminologies were different and so forth. And so I felt like we're starting from scratch again here. So fast forward a little bit. So I managed to go to high school and was able to take all kinds of classes at the same time. Sophomore English, sophomore, junior, senior English classes, civics, all this stuff that we had never taken in Iran. And I managed to actually graduate from high school and start college at age 15. So, you know, here we are in college, and I'm kind of studying, taking these classes in college and mix it up, some political science classes, some actual science classes, and so forth. And I had a tendency to go to the library and study at the library and take a little bit of a break. They had these audiovisual rooms. You would go play records back then and then come out, and there's a lounge with TV and so forth. So before I get to that point, I should say that while we were studying and doing all this stuff, the situation in Iran completely turned around very quickly, far faster than anybody anticipated. Nobody thought the Shah's regime would topple like it did, but it went down in no time. So we were watching the entire process on TV right here. Every night, Iran was on TV. We managed to do this as Iranians. We show up every so often. It's like a roller coaster ride. It was the revolution. Then we became some kind of terrorist later on. It was nuclear, and now it's Corona. So we tend to make it to the front pages quite often. But back then, it was the Shah, and it was what was going on, street demonstrations and all that. But we watched the whole thing. There's nothing you can do about it. We were here, so we continued on. I'm studying at the library, come out for a little break, and there's breaking news on TV. A bunch of Muslim students stormed the American embassy and took the diplomats as hostages. And I'm as shocked as everybody else because I knew this much. You do that to an embassy, it's literally like invading a country. You just don't do stuff like that. But these guys did it, and I'm watching it, and I'm here like everybody else. I'm watching this thing. Obviously, don't have a whole lot to do with this. There was a very different kind of reaction in the demographics that we were confronting with the college and so forth. A lot of people started taking that against us. And there were other Iranian students in that college. Of course, anytime there's a situation like this, the U.S. government is obligated to respond. And the first thing that Jimmy Carter did was to freeze all the Iranian assets. Translation of that is you lived on what you had. You were no longer going to receive any money from anywhere. The immigration law would require that as a student visa person here in this country, you had to be in school full time. And you could not work off campus. You had to work on campus part time. So we had to live with whatever job we could get on campus, which fortunately for us, the cafeteria had a lot of openings as a dishwasher. That was my first job ever in my life, to be that dishwasher at 5 o'clock in the morning, put the hat on, and receive the trays, basically, and clean up. And, you know, those of you who have either taken it there or done it, you know what I'm talking about. So that's what we were doing, but there was quite a bit of animosity going on, which was hard for us to understand. This wasn't what we envisioned when we came to this country. And we couldn't understand why we're being blamed, because we all watched this news together, right? But people had very strong feelings. A few nights later, we are sitting, what that situation caused, that whole financial situation, a bunch of us had to get together, move into a house together, so we could afford the house. And this was a very old house, directly adjacent to the main road on the street. And it was a two-level house and full of rats. Literally, like at nighttime in between the two floors, we could hear the rats kind of marching across. But that's what you had to do. And basically, that's what we could afford. And we ate a lot of peanut butter. A lot. And I still do, actually, because I know how effective it is. So one night we're sitting in the family room, a bunch of us, and early evening and watching TV after school. And they had all these sitcoms that would come back to back. And the sitcom was Happy Days with Fonz and Richie Cunningham. Some of you remember those guys. Very cool guys. Next thing we know, there's this huge sound, almost like a bomb went off. And then there's glass splashing all over the room and all of us that were sitting there. And then we noticed that the crew outside, the residents, students, whatever, had a big piece of rock and with a very nasty picture and a whole lot of interesting language written on it against us, and threw it right through the window. They just didn't think we should be there. On campus, they had banners against us, like, and the banners weren't just, you know, like a civil type of exchange. It was a lot of profanity. The students were so proud to have sprayed all kinds of profanity and different claims against us on their cars as they were driving around. So this was quite shocking. And just to describe myself at the time, I'm 15. Parents are back home. We're trying to survive here. We're washing dishes. These students would come in, big students, football players. Like if I was sitting, a number of them took political science classes for some reason. And so they would literally come into the class next to me, turn around and use some language. This might be recorded, so I won't go there. But use your imagination. And of course, I can't respond to people that big, right? Or they would come to the cafeteria, make the biggest mess they could make on their trays, take mashed potato, stick like a fork in there, draw an American flag on a piece of, you know, a napkin, bring it to us, throw it at us, spit in it, and say something and walk away. It was just a horrible, horrible situation that we just had to live with, and there was no way out of it. So as a 15-year-old, I was scared, which is why I couldn't respond. And the scary part was, this is a part of the country that people carry a lot of guns legally, and they're responsible. But what was scary for us was, we don't know which one of these people is going to react in what way to what news, none of which was within our control. I had no idea what the TV is going to show tomorrow. So everything was dark and gloomy. And here comes Glee Gasper, ultimately known to many of us as Mom Gasper. Mom Gasper was, she and her husband Don Gasper couldn't be politically farther apart. Mom Gasper was a liberal Democrat. Don Gasper was a staunch Republican. But when it came to us, they were on the exact same page. Extremely welcoming. They got to know us, and they not only vowed to protect us, they literally almost adopted us, a whole bunch of us. Their home's door was wide open. We were in and out. They were making sure we were taken care of. And I can't tell you what a blessing that was, but the breath of fresh air. Needless to say, she taught me personally lessons that I practice to date, even when I'm out, you know, visiting patients in Baltimore City. I've learned several lessons, but some of the key lessons from what she taught us in action was compassion should be number one in what we do. Embracing diversity and trying to get to know what you don't know and be accepting of others. And perhaps one of the most important thing is not only do good, but look for good in everyone. Because when we look for it, we find it. Even people that we disagree with so much to date. Those lessons have carried me throughout my so many years of life since then. And I intend to continue on and hopefully transfer this to my family, to my kids, hopefully, as I go. When I listen to the news, and have been for the last few years, having lived through all of that, it's deja vu. It's just different nationality, different type of demonizing that's going on. But it's deja vu pretty much that I experienced. Interestingly enough, I think every single one of those Iranians that I've stayed in touch with or I know that were in that college are doing significant things in whatever professions they're in. They're all doing, they're pretty influential in the society, in contributing to the society, as well as institutions where they're either practicing, has whatever, all kinds of stuff that they're doing. So if you go back, all those people that were fearful of these people, today they're actually, we're full circle back and they're actually contributing and probably hiring many of those people to support their own lives right now, right? And one last point, which is totally unrelated to my story, but kind of related. 2 days ago, I heard that one of those hostage takers just died of coronavirus, of all the things. So go figure. So that was my story. That's how I got to this country, and I'm so grateful that I'm here. Thank you, guys.
So,
you know, yeah. I was going to say what I was struck by was how young he was when all this was happening, right? 15.
I know.
And just thinking about being 15 with a, you know, in a really unfamiliar and in a lot of ways unforgiving place, and feeling unsafe in your own home, and then again the kindness of strangers appearing like a miracle, you know, and making something seem possible that hadn't seemed possible, you know.
Yeah. And you know, I love the part where he says that all of the boys who had that experience together, who lived in the house in West Virginia, now are very much about giving back to their communities and helping others. And they really still talk about how important it was that they had that experience with the husband and wife that took them in. So it was a life-changing thing for them. So that's it. That's our episode today. Before we leave you, we want to thank a very important institution in these times. The Wine Source, which I believe has a curbside pickup option where you can just call and they'll walk you through the different types of wine and beer and coffee and chocolate and bread and cheese that they have and put it out on the curb for you to retrieve in your mask like a bandit. Except you're not a bandit, you're a citizen.
Well, if it's just out on the curb, could you just take someone else's? See, oh, I thought that was trash. I'm just cleaning it up.
No, I'm learning that there's a whole like honor system. I've learned this, like they're not a sponsor, but Chipotle, like you could just go in and pick up anyone's like pre-ordered thing. But nope, I always go in and I know that Charlie Hankins is going to be sitting there fresh and ready to go.
Wow. Well, now you've just given everyone who's listening the idea to go into Chipotle and say they're Charlie Hankin and your burrito.
Yeah, I guess I have done that. Well, if you want to be that asshole that steals my son's burrito, have at it.
And it's a special burrito with, what does he get on it?
You know, chicken, pinto beans, sour cream. It's not actually very healthy. So do yourself a favor and don't get that burrito because it doesn't have any vegetables whatsoever.
Well, we will be back next week with more stories from the soup. Until then, stay safe, stay sane, wash your hands, visit our sponsors, particularly Golden West and Wine Source, get something good to drink and eat. Check us out at soupstorytelling.com as well.
Oh, yeah.
And thank you to Maureen Harvey.
Yes, we remembered. Thank you to Maureen Harvey, our amazing producer. All right, ciao.
Bye-bye.